It's great to be with you. I was here 2 years ago, or in, where were we? Sydney, I think it was. A lot changes in 2 years, though, doesn't it? A lot changed for me in 2 years. I moved from being a man in his 40s to a man in his 50s. I have a twin brother whose son just had his wife had a baby, so I'm the twin brother of a grandfather, so that really makes me very old. Sorry if your grandparents here. So a lot's changed in two years. The most significant thing that's changed for me is that I've become an extremely long-winded, boring and sanctimonious public speaker. So settle in. No, but a lot has changed in 2 years, doesn't it? And perplexing times, resilient schools. That's a cracker of a theme, and it sums up a lot. A lot has become more perplexing. The same-sex marriage vote, and not so much a watershed as a precipice, which showed us where things are actually at in our culture, as if we didn't know. The Religious Freedoms Inquiry was handed to the Turnbull government yesterday, so let's see what happens there. Funding of schools, activism outside the front gate, could that be what's next? Dare we even think what it would be like 2 years from now? The pace of change is perplexing. And what you get, it seems to be, as Christians and Christian groups, is that perplexity level goes up, and then we sort of jump on our resilience horse and try to meet it. So resilience level must rise to meet it. Perplexity level goes up, resilience level rises to meet it. Perplexity level goes up, you get the point. Rinse, launder, repeat. Perplexity level, resilience level. Is there a federal government department here of perplexity in Canberra, which just waiting for Christian organisations to amp up their level of resilience so that they can turn the perplexity dial just up that notch and watch us squirm in our conferences? Probably a camera somewhere up there. So here's our fear. Our fear is this, and it's church and other Christian organisations, I've noticed it in church settings as well, that our resilience will top out before the perplexity does. But our resilience will top out before the perplexity does. Will it all get too much and the house of cards comes crashing down so quickly? Is there a solution to what seems to be this zero-sum game? How about this? I think as Christians, the goal and the promise is to discover a resilience that's more perplexing to the culture than the perplexity that it throws at us. Do you get that? A resilience that's more perplexing than the perplexities that the culture throws at us. So we're not simply surviving and bunkering down and, ham, spam, beans, shotgun in the hills in your compound. I used to live in the church in the hills. We were ready for it already. It's just we hadn't dug the concrete bunkers. But is it just about surviving and being reactive? No. Is there a proactive, thriving, perplexing resilience that perplexes the oncoming perplexities? I told you I was long-winded, boring and sanctimonious. I think I got that right. I'll listen to it back to make sure. My 51-year-old brain doesn't function like my 49-year-old brain did. But in 2 Peter, the apostle highlights God-given resilience, not just for the individual, and we often read this text individually, how's my prayer life going, how's my lust life going, whatever it is that your thing is. His divine power has given us everything we need for life and godliness through the knowledge of him who has called us by his own glory and excellence. His divine power has given us not most things, but everything that we need for life and godliness, whether that's your individual life, for life and godliness, or whether it is for us corporately. But Peter doesn't leave it there, does he? Here's where he starts to ramp up resilience. For this very reason, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to goodness knowledge, and to knowledge self-control, and to self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, and to godliness mutual affection, or brotherly love, and to mutual affection, love. For if you possess these qualities in increasing measure, they will keep you from being ineffective and unfruitful in your knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. The key there is these qualities in increasing measure. You don't go through that list, knowledge, done it, self-control, doing it, perseverance, doing it tomorrow, You're not doing that. It's a resilience that can out-perplex the increasing perplexities. Resilience need never top out. for the Christian and the Christian community. It's like, I see your perplexity and I raise the resilience by my immeasurable divine power, says the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what's going on in this passage. I want to encourage us. I know Mark said that he had fearful stories, and I notice he is quite a fearful man. In case there was fire, he had 3 or 4 bottles of water and an exit strategy right behind him. But I want to encourage us with godly resilience in perplexing times. So 2 talks this weekend, each with a perplexing problem and each with a good reason for resilience in these perplexing times. And perplexing problem number 1, if we have it on the screen. God's people live in a world that feels ripped off. God's people live in a ripped off world. Let me explain this painting to you. This is a painting by the Spanish artist El Greco, and was painted in 1604. Does that not look like a modern painting to you? It's a highly modern looking painting. And it's called The Vision of St. John. It's taken from the book of Revelation in chapter 6, the opening of the 5th seal, where the martyrs are sitting at the under the altar, and it says, they're saying, how long, O Lord, till you avenge us of our blood? And St. John, on the island of Patmos, is seeing this vision of the heavens opened. And this was painting was in a part of a fresco, an altarpiece in a Spanish church, a massive piece of art above the altar. It's got St. John, it's got the martyrs, various states of undress waiting for white robes to come down. But the key to this painting isn't what you can see in the painting, it's what's not there. Because part of the fresco, which is now hanging in the gallery in New York, in a gallery, has been ripped off. The top 5 feet apparently went missing somewhere in about the 1900s. So there you have St. John, with his hands and his gaze reaching up for, well, something, but there's nothing up there. The original painting apparently had the picture of the risen Christ sitting on the throne, ruling and reigning. And there's St. John with a transcendent look, as he has in Revelation, looking up for something transcendent, something ultimate, which is no longer there. It's been ripped off. And the great irony that it is in that most ripped off of places, New York, where transcendence has fallen by the wayside. See, that's the challenge for churches and Christian schools and organisations. In our culture, there's a ripping off, like torn off, of the transcendent, what Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor called disenchantment. That we don't live in a world in which the spirit world engages with us and pushes back on us and is ever flowing, we're subject to the spiritual world, but we are almost like in the series Under the Dome, the CBS series, where an invisible dome comes around the town of Chester Mill. Nothing can get in. Nothing can get out. Hermetically sealed off. That's our modern secular framework. A hermetically sealed dome with nothing coming in, nothing going out. It's as if a big invisible hand, for most people in our world, has taken the top 5 feet of their thinking and ripped it off. We're operating as people committed to transcendence because that's what we were created for, committed to a God who intervenes in an enchanted world, a world in which God himself in Jesus has broken in, but the consensus is there's nothing up there. It's a ripped off world. And yet, and here's the irony of that term, guess what? People are feeling a little bit ripped off. That desire for something more lingers, unspoken, inarticulate. Just like that painting, people are reaching out, reaching up towards something, well, towards what they don't really know. Despite the modern confidence that is supposed to have been instilled in our generations, there's a sense that, is this all there is? The Me Project? Is that all there is? Our friends, family and neighbours and the kids in our schools may shrug their shoulders and admit there's nothing ultimate, nothing transcendent, but they don't feel that way. In fact, they don't live their lives that way. Their desires and their language betray them, that they feel there's something more, but surely not because we're in this hermetically sealed dome. They're still searching for significance and meaning, only they don't know where that is truly to be found. Jamie Smith puts it like this in his book, How Not to Be Secular. You're a church planter, or Christian school leader, I would assume on this, who has left your Jerusalem on a mission to Babylon. You came with what you thought were all the answers to the unanswered questions that secular people had. But it didn't take you long to realise that the questions just weren't unanswered. They were unasked. And they weren't questions. That is, your secular neighbours aren't looking for answers for some bit of information that is missing from their mental maps. To the contrary, they have completely different maps. You've realised that instead of nagging questions about God or the afterlife, your neighbours are oriented by all sorts of longings and projects and quests for significance. There doesn't seem to be anything missing from their lives, so you can't just come proclaiming the gospel of a Jesus who fills the God-shaped hole. They don't have any sense that the secular lives they've constructed are missing a second floor. In many ways, they've constructed webs of meaning that provide almost all the significance they need in their lives. That is the modern age. Whether you're a church pastor or a Christian teacher or a head of a school where you have kids coming to your school who don't know Jesus, marinated in a ripped-off world, whether they're Christian or not. We have our Sunday service at 4 p.m. at our church. All Providence congregations are in the afternoon across all our network at the moment, by accident, really. But we've been talking about how many second service people we have, people that go somewhere else in the morning and then some to us in the evening. None of you would do that. But everyone is a second service person because they have been discipled very effectively at a service called Monday to Saturday. And then they come to us at church because it's a second service. It's a reorienting of putting that 5 feet back on top of the picture, if you get what I mean. So there's a lot of challenge in what Jamie Smith said. Nothing missing from their lives. No sense that the secular lives they've constructed are missing a second floor or 5 feet of fresco. Now, maybe there's a house, a place where the staircase was, like a badly done renovation, it's been patched up. There are signs that a staircase was there, but no one's really looking to rebuild that staircase. At least not the way we'd built it, or thought it should be built. The new atheists have been saying it for years. We've painted over and nailed down all the other hundreds of gods. Let's just get rid of the last few stubborn ones, and then things will be right, especially the Christian one. And at the 2016 census, the number of Christians dropped some 10% from the 2011 census, primarily because people were given the option to tick no 5 feet, no second floor. And that is set to increase as the boomers age and the millennials take on the central place in the culture. The idea of the religious, the transcendent, as a place to look for meaning is disappearing in the modern age. Fire alarm. I actually think it's coming from the second floor, so don't worry about it. Should I keep going? Okay. So that idea of the religious or the transcendent as a place to look for meaning has disappeared in the modern age. But the fact is there's a glitch in the modern, a pressure point that I think provides us with opportunity. Listen to what Jamie Smith said again in that quote. if you can remember it from after the fire alarm. Your neighbours are oriented by all sorts of longings and projects and quests for significance. They have constructed webs of meaning that provide almost all of the significance they need in their lives. Did you note the word? Almost. There's the glitch. Almost all of the significance. Not all. Almost all. The glitch is this. If humans were factory fitted by God to worship him and find their fulfillment in doing that, then a lesser task, a lesser goal, is going to leave them feeling ripped off. Even if they cannot fully articulate that for themselves. See, here is what is not happening by and large. The modern Westerner is not throwing up his or her hands and saying, oh, well, there's nothing transcendent, no ultimate project. Let's get on with more boring, less meaningful, first floor, second rate lives. Not at all. To the contrary, they are investing deep levels of transcendency into non-transcendent goals. Deep levels of ultimacy into non-ultimate projects. Faced with the loss of the gospel, they are creating other forms of good news. Western culture cannot give up on meaning and significance. It has simply moved it one floor down. If there is no second floor, then the first floor will have to bear all of the weight of transcendence, all of the weight of ultimacy. And you see this in the ads of our day, which we just drive past. But that's our second service. Every week for 6 days, we are marinating in it. Now, as the CX3 ad, be moved like never before. Be moved like never before. I read the brief of the Mazda CX-3 ad. It says, this film for Mazda's new CX-3 sets out to represent Mazda's design mantra, the soul of motion. Hello! You know, inspired by this ideology...
False alarm.
Cool. False alarm. Run, everyone. No. Yes, sir. The narrative was approached as a motion sculpture, a striking work of art shaped by the most powerful and graceful expression of human movement, dance. Careful choreography and bespoke VFX techniques combined as a potent and iconic signature of movement. The highly architectural setting, the altar upon which the car was seated, was carefully designed to hero the presence of the car and provide a focus for the dance performance. Design mantra, mantra, ideology, hero the presence of the altar. The car is sitting on a plinth called the altar. Don't ask how do we evangelize the kids in our school. Just assume they're already being evangelized. Monday to Saturday. That's what's so perplexing. Our task is to evangelize them with a bigger, grander gospel. To truly move them like they have never been moved before by their creator, rather than settling for the created thing, the sum of all sins, in Romans chapter 1. And tomorrow I'll look at zombie apocalypses and beautiful apocalypses. Don't worry too much, though we can, about the zombie apocalypse getting your kids. The beautiful apocalypse can suck them right in. We're being evangelized 24/7 by non-transcendent and non-ultimate projects with a good news story that they're providing, you know, transcendency, and they're not. Humans need that second floor. So what do in its absence? They push all of their first floor projects upwards. And in the modern West, what is the most popular project to push up to that second floor? Me. Project me. We are our own transcendent project. We have the technology. We are our own quest for significance. Which brings me to my second hand raised to the heavens. Bruce Jenner. The cultural hero of the transcendent project. 1976 Olympic decathlon champion. The pinnacle of manhood. 42 years ago. But struggling with gender dysphoria all his life. I would not want us to mock him, because it's a very real issue, a that he struggled with. My wife is a clinical psychologist and deals with this all of the time. But the glitch for Bruce Jenner is that Olympic gold was not transcendent enough for Project Bruce. It was a first for project pushed upwards, but it didn't make it the whole way up the staircase. Something was lacking. The pinnacle of manhood was lacking. Thomas Chalmers, crusty old Puritan preacher who I love, talked about the exclusive or expulsive power of a new affection. The expulsive power of a new affection. He said humans never have a time in their lives where there's not something central to their loves and their heart. And he explains it in his usual crusty 18th century way of a man is into games and toys when he's young, and then he moves it to power and then politics. And then, but there's no point in his life, whatever age he goes through, where there isn't something that captures his affections on the throne of his heart. It's not possible. And each affection is expelled by a new affection. And Chalmers saying that the only affection that can last and remain is the affection of God in Christ, the second floor, truly. But we're built where we just affection after affection. So Project Me never finally reaches somewhere that it needs to. Our culture has moved even beyond thinking about that, what I want externally. That's not enough transcendence for us. We have the technology to take our transcendence to a much deeper level than Thomas Chalmers could have ever envisaged. And that's why you get the pinnacle of womanhood and the pinnacle of manhood in the same person 42 years apart. In 42 years, we've been able to do that. The modern age holds out the hope of transcendence at that deep level. After Bruce Jenner transitions to Caitlyn Jenner. But even then, what does Caitlyn Jenner say? I carry the old Bruce with me all of the time, always struggling and deep down to get out. Here is Jenner as an icon for the self as transcendent project, the search for ultimacy, the ability to break limits. The promise of a culture is that we can ascend to not only that second floor, but the sky is the limit. We can get in the glass elevator and go all the way higher than that. Even at the same time that it denies there is anything outside that hermetically sealed dome. That explains why there's such heat towards the gospel from what I call the secular culture. It's not simply different ideas or a battle to fill a God-shaped hole. It's a transcendency war, an ultimate battle. When you're the Russians fighting for Stalingrad and there's nowhere left to go, you fight with all your life. And if there is nowhere else to go, if this is it, then everything is hinged on this. This is all there is. Hence, this is why it made no sense, I think, culturally, in the same-sex marriage debate, when Christians were saying, we don't have to agree with what you do to love you. And that just wasn't a category. That was a category error. That wasn't understood by the proponents of same-sex marriage, and especially by gay people, because they are their ultimate transcendent project, as they assumed everyone should be. See, we had landed on the wrong floor. We were assuming ground floor categories in that discussion. We were assuming people understood that we viewed them as having value at a second floor level, when all along they assumed that that's where we are with us, second floor. And that we were denying them the significance and ultimacy that's up there. And we're going, no. And I go, actually, different categories. To people in a wider culture thinking second floor, it was simply this. Our gospel, our good news, was not good news for them. It was bad news, very bad news indeed. And political and legal power is working hard with soft cultural power, think Qantas, think rugby, to embed that gospel in our national psyche. That's where we're at. This is the perplexity facing gospel communities. I didn't want us to run screaming from here as if there were a fire. But it sounds quite challenging, doesn't it? It sounds very perplexing. And you know this stuff. I'm not telling you stuff you don't know. You know this. Whether it's churches or schools. This is the perplexity that sees funding perhaps threatened. That sees what we view as good news as hate speech. No matter how we try to cover that over. No matter what we say. Charles Taylor says this, that for the first time in human history, anywhere, anytime, here in the West, the goal of human flourishing is human flourishing. Never before, never anywhere else, has human flourishing been the end game. There was always a higher goal, a second floor, the glory of God. But with that challenge, there's an opportunity. With the perplexity comes a gospel resilience that betrays the lack of true resilience within the ripped-off culture. Despite the Me Project and all of its promises of transcendence, the cracks do show, don't they? People are wondering why this supposed second floor isn't giving them the view that they paid for. We just moved into a two-story house, and you know my wife is sick of this illustration. But we built this place, and it's got a view. But if I just built that, and it suddenly was nothing to see from there, I'd feel a little bit ripped off. In his book Sex in the Eye World, Dale Kuhn observes, despite the promises, the culture is not delivering. Two of the primary difficulties facing people in our culture are loneliness and insecurity. And if I can be so crass, we built a two-story house because the clinical psych practice is going very well indeed on the basis of the amount of loneliness and insecurity in an otherwise well-heeled, well-fed, well-educated world. Which brings me to a fourth picture. You know the movie The Truman Show? Another hand reaching up. Now, that is an amazing movie for all of its, it's got things you go, oh, don't follow that storyline or that storyline, and people have interpreted it different ways as if it's trying to suppress a religious framework. But I think even if it were trying to do that, that's impossible. You know the premise that Truman feels there must be something more. I mean, this hermetically sealed dome, he doesn't know that's what it is. But there must be more than the Monday to Saturday discipleship program of product placement. And he makes every effort, despite everyone else going against him, to get over into that boat, conquer his fears on the water, and get to whatever it is on the other side. And what is the noise he makes when he touches that wall? He gasps. He gasps. Because at that moment, he realizes there's more truth than he's been told about. There is something outside the dome. There is something truly transcendent, despite the constant lure of the imminent frame, as Charles Taylor calls it, that down below first floor, pulling him back. That's the glitch in the modern. It's harder the older people get. But if you face students who are looking at that and going, really? That's what I have to look forward to? That's it? That gives you great opportunity, doesn't it? So how does it look for me as a church pastor, for you as Christian educators? That idea that there's something more, that we know it's true, and we know it's true because God in Christ has broken through that dome, come to this earth. How does that give us resilience? Well, I think given time, the cultural tsunami will start to deposit the bodies on the shoreline. And that may not be next year or the next 5 years, but you're building for a resilience and to be a community, an alternate ethical community for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years when those bodies start washing up on the shore. When the people who've tried it all, pushed as far as they could push, done as much of the Me Project as they could afford and had time for, and it's still not enough. Still not enough. And they feel ripped off by the cultural promises that they can have a second floor. And they go to the wall. Yeah. Is that it? Is that it? They're still looking for something transcendent, something beyond the dome, something ultimate and enchanted, aren't they? Now, what does that look like for me in church? Because it's very easy to preach it to everyone else, but I run a bit, and another athlete that I run with, I've met in running at different races, another bloke called Steve, a Kiwi man of my age. I got to know him at Parkrun. Parkrun, by the way, is like church without Jesus. It's the ultimate salvation story. Community, love, acceptance. It doesn't matter if you're... Thank you. Thank you. Anyway, Steve, this Kiwi man who runs a lot of races, said to me last year after a race, he came up to me and said, "Hey, bro, I read some stuff you write." Oh, crap, you know. Oh, it's another Stephen Calpine. "I might come to your church." What? I think I'd like that sort of stuff. Really? I mean, yes, of course you would, because, you know. But as he started coming, he has started, been coming for the last 2 months, sign me up for everything. "No, really, you've got to be have objections," and, you know, no, sign me up. Okay, you know. In short, he's feeling ripped off. 51, failed marriage, no one else involved in that, just a drift apart over 10 years. Is this it? He's been coming, though, for the last 2 months as part of his Steve project. There's a difference. He's searching for meaning and significance in a way that he could maybe renovate the house and put a second floor up there. He's going, "This is good. I need to be involved in these things." And he's even helping in our Gospel Deeds program. But a couple of weeks ago, something changed imperceptibly. A shift, a glitch, as we were preaching over, we're going through 1 and 2 Kings at the moment. He had an almost moment, a sense that there might be a second floor that he can't actually construct for himself. He came up to me and said, "I think we need to meet up. I think we need to talk about what this Christian thing actually means, because my confidence in what it means doesn't mean I'm right about what it means." Would that be right? Do you see the... It's taken time. Being confident, he says, doesn't mean that I'm right. I like that attitude. And we're having coffee when I get back to talk about that second floor, to talk about how the gospel isn't there for an upgrade on the Steve quest, but it's a call to die. To die to the dome thinking, to die to himself, and to live to the one who came and from there to here to die for him. So please pray for him. Pray that he reaches his Truman Show gasp moment, that he realizes there's something transcendent that he can hold his hands towards you. And how about you, as you lead Christian teachers, as you shape educational communities in these perplexing times? Are students coming to you, to your schools, from families who are doing the family project, aiming for something better than what they were getting somewhere else, aiming for something that gives their kids more than they even had themselves, perhaps? What does it give you? As communities, it gives you the opportunity to point to that second floor, but not just to point to it, to model your lives together as if the second floor matters. As if forgiving each other in the context of a school community matters. As if bearing one another's burdens matters, because someone came from above to below to do that and to show us that that is the true project. Not self-improvement, but self-denial. Perplexing times will continue to be so, but our resilience is built on knowing that the truth of the Christian gospel provides meaning, significance, and ultimacy beyond what the world can offer, no matter how much money it throws at it. That's why I love the fact that there's a door. You see, here's the glitch in the modern. We may not believe, assent to, that there's anything beyond us. But how ripped off would you feel if he got to that wall, bumped into it in his boat, there's nothing beyond it, got in the boat and sailed back? There had to be a door. Because you would feel ripped off. The most hardened atheist would feel ripped off if there wasn't a door. And I believe Christian schools are the front line now because they're often the first and only place that many young people find out that there's a top 5 feet of the picture that's been ripped off. In my daughter's school, we're at Swan Christian College, and I'm on the board of Skier, as you may have heard. Thanks for that. 85% non-Christians. They're at that school to find out that there's something more, that there's something towards which they can stretch their hands and their hands will be filled. That will satisfy not simply at school or university, but into eternity. Our resilience is built upon that conviction, first and foremost, is it not? Whatever happens to funding, whatever happens to anti-discrimination legislation, a ripped-off world will have to one day discover that it has been ripped off, whether they find that out now or when that dome gets split open. And then, if it raises its hands for something more, it will discover a transcendent king who broke through the dome, came down to us in the person of the perplexing and resilient Jesus, who went to the cross so that none of us should ever feel ripped off again. Amen.